Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Platypus, the extraordinary story of how a curious creature baffled the world, by Anne Morrell. The 12th episode in reading this book, chapter 15, so I've done a few episodes of two chapters. The last couple of episodes have been shorter, because they've been fairly significant chapters in themselves. I believe this is the last chapter. And as usual, there's a quote from some rather good books, Biology of Monitoring, 78, The Relationship by Mervyn Griffiths. The relationship of the monotremes to the rest of the mammals continues to be a matter of debate. And from Unsourced Aboriginal Song, Bubbling Beak and Flapping Feet. From the 1960s, an upsurge of research interest in Australia and elsewhere added new knowledge to the physiology, ecology, biochemistry, paleontology of the monotremes. In 1995, Tom Grant's The Platypus extended the knowledge of the platypus's ecology, tracing the annual cycle of the platypus life and revealing how these evolutionary survivors have adapted successfully to their modern environment in southeastern Australia. It's an annual cycle. The platypus progresses through the rigours of winter to the frenzied activities of spring mating and rearing, and the more leisurely times of summer to autumn. Grant wrote, quote, "For all platypuses, the autumn season is one of preparation for the winter ahead. At the end of autumn, most adult platypuses are at their maximum weight and their fur is the best condition. For juveniles, this reason is the time many of them are dispersing and are probably a time preceding considerable juvenile mortality over the winter, especially when drought reduces the available habitat. The platypus as a species has been going through this annual cycle for a very, very long time, but it's only now that we are aware of what each season means to the Latin name for platypus." Among the many oddities associated with the animal's physiology is surely the platypus's extraordinary capacity for consuming food. Bennett sensed this, stuffing his luckless captives with meat and worms, but he got it badly wrong. Bernard was defeated by the enormous amounts required to sustain several animals in captivity, but he was the first to observe that the platypus could each catch half its own body weight in live prey during one night's feeding. The animal's skill in diving underwater darkness, using only the sense of touch to locate prey, convinced Bernal that it must have a sixth sense to determine its direction. Some 70 years later, for leaps in platypus understanding were typically slow, the German physiologist Henning Stich of the Technical University of Darmstadt was sent a pickled platypus ahead by the curator of the Australian. National University Zoological Museum, examining at the same time a close-up photograph of the platypus bill and noting the dense array of pores scattered on the skin surface. Schirix postulated these pores could be sense organs similar to those found on the skin of certain marine and freshwater fish, who located their prey and communicated with each other by means of electrical fields. In 1985, Stillich, an assistant, came to Canberra to explore his hunch with his colleagues from the Australian National University. German interest in the platypus had flickered strongly across the years. Early in the 19th century, a debate on the platypus quickened. Michel and Bayer pushed out pioneering anatomical frontiers. 70 years on, zoologist and embryologist Richard Sermons trains Ernest Haeckel and of Jena spent time during 1892 to 93 on Queensland's Burnett River, close to the site of Codwall's investigation, where, like the Scottish biologist before him, he turned his gaze to the disciplined energy to study the lungfish, Cretosis, as an ovoporous animal. So, it's an egg-laying mammals. Like Codwall, Sermon relied heavily on the help from Aborigines. Bagged a horde of platypus, made Catstorm Affair, quote, as a nice keepsake from the Atipodos, his friends at home, and recorded observations of the platypus' teeth. and the range of body temperatures of monotremes, the habits of echidnas and platypus, and their long survival across geological time in his book called In the Australian Bush. A century after Sermon, Senich in Australia struck to the laboratory. Placing the platypus in a large tank, he found the animal would dive to the bottom, overturn bricks that concealed live batteries, while ignoring bricks where the batteries were flat. In the second experiment, the platypus was confronted with a large perspex screen suspended in the water between a shielded, which shielded a live battery. Swimming it accustomedly away with its eyes eased, nasal cavity closed, the animal dived eagerly around the screen. It bumped into it unsuspectedly when the battery was flat. The platypus electric, a monotreme furnished with a unique electroreception, was unveiled. Shear's flashpoint of discovery revealed that the platypus used electric sense underwater for both avoiding obstacles and finding food in the murky habitat. So sophisticated was the sixth sense, the animal could detect prey tucked away in the mud and under rocks. It was a far cry from the general belief that the platypus simply plundered along the bottom of the stream, seizing whatever food it could. All animals generate some electricity in their contracting muscles when they make movements. Some, like fish and amphibians, also use electrosensory systems for generating active pulses of communication, or in the case of electric eels, for reducing electric fields quick enough to stun its prey. By contrast, these findings indicated that the platypus was a passive electrodetector, sussing out the prey through electric sensors in the bill. While sight and hearing played no part in the vigorous filling of its cheek passes, the platypus found its diverse cuisine at a distance using electrolocation. Its favourite fruit, freshwater swim, popped into the experimental tank, was found to generate electric fields through its tail flip, large enough to be detected by platypus 10 centimetres away. Most significantly for science, the experiment indicated the electrical stimulation of the platypus bill worked quite differently from that of fish or sonar have electrolocation used by whales or bats by evoking electrical responses from the surface of the platypus's brain. The bold announcement of discovery with its cover page illustration, Electrolocation of the Duck-billed Platypus, in the National Weekly Journal of Science Nature, was greeted with amazement and some disbelief. That quirky Australian animal had done it again. There was another shock for science. The discovery, declared one Australian curator of mammals firmly, ranked as, quote, one of the major natural history discoveries of the era, of this era in the world. Stirred by the finding, researchers in Victoria swung into action. At Monash University in Melbourne, a group of colleagues led by physiologist Erik Poschke took up the challenge. Many moonlit nights on the banks of the local streams later, they had the elusive animal in their net. Examining it under anaesthetic, they soon discovered that from nerve fibre recordings that the mucous sensory glands under duckbill skins were the site from the electrical activity flow. These electroreceptors were not, it proved, randomly distributed across the bill, but lay in lines over the shield. Ever since the animal's first dramatic appearance in London, nearly two centuries early, the curious flap of skin extending from the base of the duckbill's upper and lower jaws had puzzled fixed observers. Its very presence suggested the animal was a hoax. Mother Nature would never have made a botched and so untidy join. The role of the offending shield, says Perk, long remained a subject of circulation, yet, with the many receptors he and his research teams discovered on it, he speculated the shield probably helped provide the platypus with a three-dimensional view of the electric world. Research of the electric monotreme opened unexpected new doors. In certain marine freshwater fish, their electric receptors were known to consist of sterilized hair cells that communicates with the skin surface. Here, the receptor cells respond to stimulating voltage by secreting a chemical which excites the nerve fibers. In the case of the platypus, the electric stimulus excites the nerve fiber directly, and there is no chemical mediator. Excited researchers now grasp the fact that not only had the nature produced at least two distinctly different electrosensory systems in the evolutionary sense, but in Pursuit's words, quote, if an entire sensory system had evolved de novo in the platypus, it must be considered a highly evolved animal, not just a primitive transition between reptiles and animals. Quote, we believe, Prestwick wrote elsewhere, it left the mainstream of mammalian evolution a long time ago, long enough to have evolved a completely new sensory system. Thus, as far from the old notion of Australia as a mammalian penal colony, a faunal gulag, I love it. Here, as Australia's leading monitoring authority, Merv Griffith has expressed, it was the mammal of all time. At Sydney's Stronger Park Zoo, an exuberant curator of mammals, Dr. Didi Woodside, spelled out the message, quote, Australians, she told the local press in November 1985, have long regarded their animals as a group which is dying out, almost something we have to apologise for. We have here an evolution isolation, a mammal developing this trait in Australia independently of anything else. They're not dying out, they're becoming more and more specialised. It's very exciting. The platypus has been tagged by Darwin as a key exemplar of a principle of evolution, adaptation in isolation, and now, over a century after the origin of species, his point had been dramatically established. Yet over what vast periods of geological time has this process of adaptation occurred? What do we know about the evolution of this specialised resident monotreme? Australia, contained within the sunland mass of Gondwana, broke away from the Earth's continent some 225 million years ago. So that's just the very start of the dinosaur era. Let me see. No, 280 million years ago is dinosaurs. First joined with Africa, South America, Antarctica, India, and Madagascar. Linked and later alone, she drifted through a long series of challenging climatic zones that shaped the evolution of her unique flora and fauna. The piecing together of this evolution has been slow and arduous. The fossil record has only recently offered up its fragmentary but telling clues. In 1987, a vivid dry orange country of Lightning Ridge in the opal region of Walgett in New South Wales yielded a small fragment of an apalized jaws containing three highly distinctive teeth that revealed it to be a monotreme. An opal monotreme? Wow! Gleaming in the bright sunlight, the world's only transparent fossil, declared the press, it was a relic of Australia's oldest fossil mammal. A remote, large-sized platypus ancestor from the Cretaceous period some 100 million years ago in the Mesozoic era of geological time. The animal would have inhabited a landscape of broad river estuary and inland sea very different from Lightning Ridge to its low arid hills today. It would have swum at the feet of herbivore dinosaurs long after the bones of the distant forebears were encased in sedimentary rock. The land was uplifted with silica-rich groundwater seeping through the sediment, dispersed the bones and replaced them perfectly with perfect opals. I love opals. The distinct creature named the Strepodon galmoundi, fiery teeth suggest the monotreme precursor of great antiquity. Significantly larger and stumpier than the present platypus, but sharing many traits including a flesh-covered bill, a distinctive posture, very small eyes, and the absence of an external ear. A decade earlier, in 75, two fossil teeth of a more recent platypus predecessor from the Miocene epoch some 15 to 25 million years ago were found in deposits of an ancient lake bed in South Australia, morphologically akin in root and form to those living juvenile platypuses. Their fossilised teeth were large and less complex. In the present-day platypus, teeth are only found in the very young animal and are replaced by large horny pads which serve as efficient grinders of the food. The extinct creature was named by the paleontologist Obduron insignis, significantly enduring teeth. Subsequently, an unearthed leg bone fragments from the first close relative of the modern platypus were dated to some 4.5 million years ago. And as this sentence issued from my word processor by early 2000, the Australian media has announced finding a small leg bone similar in size and shape to that of living platypus dredged from the sediments on Queensland's Darling Down, evidencing an age between 20 and 200,000 years. Well, I love that. From my word processor. I love the word processor. Someone nowadays writes word processor in 2000. It's a lovely 2000 thing. One thing seems certain is the monotremes, as Griffiths writes, quote, are a taxon of mammals. The Mesozoic origin, which have survived the vicissitudes of millions of years of existence during which their relatives have gone to the wall. Genetic data suggests that the ancestors of platypuses split from the line which evolved into monotremes relative to the echidna, into its monotreme relative, the echidna, some 60 million years ago. Okay, so we've got them splitting from monotremes, or teat-bearing animals, or 166 million years ago, and this is the echidna deviated from platypus 60 million years ago. For at least 40,000 years, some anthropologists calculate up to 60,000 or more, the Aborigines have inhabited Australia. Their knowledge of the platypus has been both practical and totemic. Over long centuries, they have known its singular habits and physiognomy, being both delighted and repelled by it as a source of food, and have woven it into their dreaming stories. During 1844, the enlightened protector of Aborigines in the colony of Victoria, George Actus Robson, travelling about his domain and documenting the language and culture of Indigenous people, recorded a creation story that linked the platypus with the formation of the Great Snowy River, which joins the Monaro country of New South Wales with Victoria. It ran, quote, "The moon made the rivers, took a large quantity of sea water to the mountains beyond Monaro, i.e. the Snowy Mountains. On its journey amongst the mountains, it's scented by a platypus, which smelt the water, and the moon rested. The moon went a long way, and the water mole, or platypus, still tracked and finding the moon asleep." Stuck a yam stick in the water, where it gushed out and formed a river, and the moon was thus Kubish Big and Sulky. Big Sulky was thus a big sulky. At the far northern tip of the continent, the dry regions of Cape York, the recently revealed prehistoric rock art of the Quicken shows the platypus figures painted in a linear style with dark red pigment. The drawing is in a well-protected site along the Diprotodont and the koala. All three animals are now extinct in the region. The platypus placement in the artwork suggests that this was a haunt of the animal in an earlier period, and that the platypus had been a place of local dreaming. Teachings from the dreaming, that is the religion, for the Aboriginal people explain the physical spiritual phenomena and the rules governing the interrelationship between people, land and spiritual belief. They are linked with the totemism by which certain clan or language group have selected living creatures such as the kangaroo, emu, guano, lizard, snake and fish, especially named companions as totem guides. In practice, a clan must select a totem before it can occupy a hunting ground, and these totems are woven as key presences into Aboriginal dreamings. In the relationship of totems to one another, the unique character of the platypus placed it as an unusual position in the family of animals. Following the tale of the Berwina people of the Darling River in New South Wales, recorded the famous Aboriginal teacher and author David Unaparan reveals the long thread of the Aboriginal knowledge of the platypus and its waves. "There was a time, Unapon's story goes, quote, when the animals, birds, reptiles multiplied so greatly in number that the country in which they lived was not large enough to accommodate them. the kangaroo and the koala assembled with the bird tribes and the goanna target snake who represented the reptiles to confer on this difficult overcrowding. The kangaroo introduced the platypus to the assembly. He is present here this day, he declared, because he belongs to a class that is a majority in numbers. His family is more than the whole of my race and your family, O bird tribe, and placing your family with ours, our reptile tribe, this gentleman outnumbers us still. The kangaroo asked the reptiles and the birds, could they ask the platypus to take some means to prevent their rapid increase? Just look to either side of this range of mountains. Platypuses in great numbers are to be seen everywhere. Impatient at the long conference, the frugal-legged lizard whose totems were the elements of lightning, thunder, rain, hail, and wind called upon them to bring a great deluge to destroy the platypus family. They had come too numerous and were more easily overtaken in the flood than other families. Great dark clouds mantled the clear sky, and lightning flashed and thunder roared, and the wind came howling, driving the rain and hail into every hiding place of animal and bird reptile. The animals were able to hide from the storm, but the platypus were all killed. The platypus were no more. 3 years later, the carpet snake, acting on the report from the cormorant, reported that the animal had been found, and the platypus hiding a quite distant mountain stream. Kangaroo called a great meeting. Poor platypuses, getting pretty done over at this stage. The question now arose, Unapon tells, as to whose platypus relatives were so that they could be more likely to help them in future. Black Duck could see the resemblance to Witchin Duck, and which has a combed teeth along the edge of its bill, so the birds swore to help the platypus. The pelican added that he must be related because he laid eggs. Reptiles could see no real relationship except possibly the egg. The animals thought they were related but could not see how. The kangaroo offered platypus the most beautiful bride from the animal, bird or reptile. A long discussion followed as to the correct relationship of the platypus to others, but the platypus chose the bandicoot as the tribe to which he would be allied. He chose the young bandicoot wife and hence has related to the hairy tribe. But one of these, the water rat, became jealous, and there was a great battle which the platypus won with the assistance of the bandicoot wives. So, runs the story, the platypus, although he has tried to break away from the bird tribe, is never reminded that his wife lays eggs and still retains a bird-like duck bill. He has tried hard to separate himself and family from the birds. He has succeeded getting rid of the feathers that the emu reminded him of, and he wore long, long ago. He tried to sever his connection with the animals, but this he also failed. He still belongs to the kangaroo possum tribe. He is making a desperate effort to cause a great gulf between himself and the kangaroo, who looks upon him with pity. The more he tries, the greater becomes the difficulty. So he makes no more effort, but simply contents himself to be neither bird, reptile, or kangaroo, but a plain platypus. He no longer seeks the companionship of the animal, bird, or reptile family, but lives affectionately with his wife in the rivers of the billabongs. And in songs he petitions the god of food, give me more grubs as the water ripple, and make me bread from the Nadu sea. Do this often and often as the sun do rise, I shall gather in the shade of the night. The food thou shalt throw into the water hunting place of mine, because I'm hiding all day, fearing that someone may call up the lightning, thunder and rain. Well, that's a lovely story, but it's sort of saying it's their taxonomy, their totems. Annalyn's dreaming story, an oral legend of the Aboriginal people, was found was to find an unexpected outlet some 30 years before it saw print in an early Australian book for children, Dot and the Kangaroo, published in 1899. The author, Ethel Pedry, a talented musician, often spent time visiting her brother in his pastoral property at Walgett, New South Wales, where she grew to know the Australian bush and its creatures and gained knowledge of the Aboriginal people. Combining this in her clear grasp of evolutionary principles and a nod to Christianity, she created the story of a small heron Dot, lost in the tangled green forest, which was to become a classic Australian literature. A female kangaroo, searching for her lost baby, Joey, stops to help Dot find her way home, but not before giving her some special berries of understanding to eat, which allowed her to communicate with animals. I'd never seen a platypus, said Dot. Do tell me what it's like. I couldn't describe it, said the kangaroo with a shudder. It seems to make up parts from three different sorts of creatures. None of us can account for it. It must have been an experiment when all the rest of us were made, or else it was made from the odds and ends of birds and beasts that were left over after we were all finished. Little Dot clapped her hand. Oh, dear kangaroo, she said. Do take me to see the platypus. There can be nothing like it in Noah's Ark. I say not, remarked the kangaroo. The animals in the ark said they were each to be of its kind, and every sort of bird beast refused to admit the platypus because it was of so many birds, and the last of Noah turned it out to swim for itself because there was such a row. That's why platypus is so secluded. Ever since then, no platypus is friendly with any other creature. No animal or bird is more than just polite to it. They couldn't be, you see, because that's the trouble in the ark. But that was so long ago, said Dot. After all this time, the platypus and all the bush creatures the same, and now then, No, returned the kangaroo. And some say there's no ark, no fuss over matter. But that, of course, doesn't make any difference, for it's a very ancient quarrel, so it must be kept up. But if we are to go to the platypus, we had better start now. There's a good time to see it. So come along, little Dot, said the kangaroo. Found the platypus beside the stream, Dot and the kangaroo listened as it sings to them in the antediluvian forebears. It breaks my heart, this is a quote, to think they're all fossils, it exclaimed mournfully, shaking its head. Fossils, it repeats, as it's plunging into the pool and swimming away, fossils. The platypus continues to lead a quiet life in the rivers of eastern Australia, rippling its way through thousands of streams and far mountain slopes and creeks and reservoirs near towns and cities. It remains a private and elusive. It inhabits the inland river systems and their near tributaries and stretch of Cooktown. In North Queensland, along the Great Dividing Range, and major rivers of New South Wales, Murray Darling Basin, Victoria, and on to Tasmania. Adapted to the tropic streams and river, the cold alpine waters of the snowy mountains, increasingly to the urban rivers sites near Melbourne, a small handful of platypuses were taken from the mainland to Kangaroo Island between 1928 and 46, and their descendants are the sole remaining group to be found breeding in the wild in South Australia. Although ecologically vulnerable to pollution in waterways from garbage, fishing lines and nets and agricultural developments, the platypuses are not rare, although with its covert twilight ways, sighting the wild can be difficult. The air-breathing mammal, it spends some 17 hours a day in the water resting in its underground burrow and is rarely observed on land except for a few minutes. The male, in an intemperate adventure in search of food and sex in the mating season, can travel up to 11 kilometres in a night and with a special memory that allows him to navigate a long distance. It lives approximately 5 years. The female keeps to a smaller environmental range and lives over 8 years and has sometimes considerably more. Both male and female are essentially solitary. Research continues to open up knowledge on the physiology and habits of this small, engaging creature, now internationally recognised as an Australian icon. The question that puzzled early researchers on what happened in the nesting burrow has now been deciphered. The female incubates her one or two, and sometimes but rarely three eggs, in her nesting burrow and for 10 to 11 days, and suckles the young until they leave the burrow 3 or 4 months after birth. Well furred and able to swim, fine fur makes up some 900 hair coverings, each square millimeter of skin. It has two layers, a woolly undercoat and a shiny longer guard hair, which together trap a layer of air and next to the platypus skin, keeping it most of its body dry when driving. The contentious spur located on the hind leg of the male is now conclusively known to secrete venom, which is used by the mature males in the breeding period and when competing for mates and territories. It's sometimes used as a defensive weapon against humans and dogs when shot or caught, and research goes on to search for an anti-venom. The platypus is thus the only Australian animal known to be venomous. The platypus is now protected by law throughout Australia and is not allowed to be taken overseas for any purpose. Conservation guidelines, urban platypus programs and tagging, monitoring, radio tracking and reporting of platypus sightings, and research and education program involving participants of all ages and designed to ensure preservation of this unique mammal are conducted by the Australian Platypus Conservancy in Victoria, Earthwatch Australia, and community groups in Tasmania and Queensland. Note, New South Wales is not them. While information and understanding of the platypus expands, more research remains to be done. Yet one point emerges clearly, that a platypus with its strange melange of characters and affinities associated within mammal, reptile, and birds is not, as the 19th century theorists and many 20th century biologists insist, a primitive animal. Instead, as biologist Stephen Jay Gould asserts, it's an animal actively evolving in its own interests. A new century for the platypus has arrived. Wonder remains in the light. Australians have adopted the little animal as their talisman, swimming and diving quietly across time. The platypus smiles. Brilliantly constructed book. Congratulations, Anne Morrill, a well-known historian science of Australian science, and has held research and teaching positions in a number of Australian universities. She's the author of many books and papers and the founder and past president of the Independent Scholars Association of Australia. She now lives in Canberra. Thanks for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. How you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.